reading starts on at verse 36, which is at the bottom of the page. Now, one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And when a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. And as she stood behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. And when the Pharisees who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of a woman she is, that she is a sinner." And Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" And Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned towards the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little loves little." And then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." And the other guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace."
Well, it's nice to be with you tonight. My brother, who I love dearly, is not a Christian. But he is the all-Australian boy. Well, not a boy anymore, he's almost my age. He lives on 100 acres in the bush near a country town in New South Wales. They own about 35 cattle. I was there the other day and all the cattle have names, but they know very clearly who's going to be eaten next. He still plays cricket, and at age 48, he's still a brilliant cricketer. Last year he told me that he got 140 runs one afternoon, and the young guys, young enough to be his kids, two or three of them lay down and didn't want to chase the ball anymore. So a few years ago we were driving back from a country town, and we'd just been getting a load of firewood. And we're in his utility, his truck. He works as a carpenter. And a load of firewood in the back. And as we drove back, he was talking to me about his hero, Peter Brock. Unfortunately, Peter Brock was killed in a racing accident a couple of years ago. It was just before that. And my brother talked to me about Peter Brock, Australia's greatest racing driver, and why he was his hero. He said Peter Brock's been the greatest driver ever, and listed some of his achievements. And then Peter Brock's a great businessman, and he'd earned millions of dollars and so on, and he stood up to the motor companies. And he said, "You know, Peter Brock's like my hero, my inspiration. He helps me get out of bed in the mornings." And I said, "Uh-huh, mm-hmm, all right, I've listened." And then he said, "He's my hero. Who's your hero? Who's your inspiration?" So I took a deep breath and said, "Well, actually, it's Jesus." And there was complete silence. And he looked out, both of us just kind of looked straight ahead through the windscreen, and all you could hear was the wheels on the road. And after 2 or 3 miles, he turned to me and said, "Well, that killed that, didn't it?" And my guess is that everyone here can relate to one or other of the brothers. And that is, some of us would say, "Yes, I do follow Jesus, and I think he's wonderful. In fact, more than just follow him, he's the Lord of my life, and I live my life for him." And there'd be others of us who say, I just don't get it. I don't understand. Like, Jesus is this kind of distant religious figure that you see in stained glass windows, in a kind of a nightie, holding a lamb, George Michael beard. It's just kind of, it's hard. It's a little like Captain Cook in Australia. Like, you've heard of him and you knew he did good work, but hard to be too enthusiastic about it. What I'd like to do is look at that part of the Bible that was just read for us, that part of Luke's Gospel, and show you some reasons why you should have Jesus not just as your inspiration, but as the one you live for, the one you know and trust, and look to forgiveness. It's in Luke's Gospel there on page 31. It's the story of Jesus and two other characters, a man and a woman. And as so often the case, it touches us where we live, because the man and the woman have very different reactions to Jesus. And for each of us, how we react to Jesus will really depend on how we view ourselves. The man and the woman see themselves very differently and so see Jesus differently. The way we see ourselves will affect how we see Jesus. Let me read it with you from Luke chapter 7, and I'll read from verse 36. Now, one of the Pharisees, they were the religious leaders of the time, one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When the word reclined means literally that, in the Middle East in those days, they would kind of almost lie down with their chest and shoulders close to the table so you could reach over and grab the bread and dip it in the different dishes and so on. You'd lie with your upper body close to the table and your feet away from the table. So the guests would recline with their feet away from the table. Feet were dirty and they'd been, you know, covered in dust and so on. So you lay like the spokes of a wheel away from the table. And as I read what the experts tell me, in a rich man's house like this, probably the biggest house in the village, the ordinary people of the village were actually able to come and sit around the edges of the room, sit on against the wall and listen to the important people as they spoke. So Jesus comes in, reclines at the table, and there is this day an unexpected visitor. You see, verse 37, when a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. And as she stood beside him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. The ointment, or the perfumed oil, as it could be translated, in an alabaster flask, is incredibly expensive. There's another incident mentioned later in Jesus' life where it talks about the perfume being worth a year's wages. And to open the jar meant to use it all. And she's come in with this jar to pour it on his feet. As I read it and think, I don't think she planned this particularly well. She'd come in, she was going to pour the perfume or the ointment on his feet. She's begun to weep. The tears have landed on dirty feet covered in dust and it's kind of muddy. And then she can't find a tea towel or whatever it is she needs. And so she wipes his feet with her hair. Now, I didn't actually understand this properly, I think, until 2 years ago. My wife Kathy and I went to Egypt, and we spent a couple of weeks in Egypt. And all of a sudden, this story made sense. I understand, when you're in a society where women veil their hair, why? Because their hair is this precious, beautiful thing that's only for them and their husband. It's kind of intimate and precious and her glory. I now understand. She undoes her hair, this beautiful thing that she has, and she wipes his feet, his muddy, dirty feet, with her hair. Now, it's not quite an erotic thing, but I guarantee this had the complete attention of every man in the room. She's, whoa, all right? And he lets her do it. He lets her do it. This is an amazing act of devotion and love, and she wipes the dirt and mud from his feet with this most precious thing that she has, her hair. Do you notice verse 37 says she'd lived a sinful life? Where I grew up, she would have been called a slut. Now, how do you feel about a bishop in a church building saying that? I've said it in different parts of Australia, given this talk, and you could hear the intake of breath. He what? And why do I say that? I say it because that feeling that you can have, and some of you may have had, that he shouldn't really say that here, that is exactly the feeling that the religious man has as he looks at Jesus and Jesus letting this woman touch him. That feeling of, well, if he was really a holy man, he wouldn't do that because he would know who she is, and really she's... Well, you see what he says? Verse 39, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. Do you see his view of religion is this? The way to please God is to separate yourself from anyone that's kind of dodgy or immoral. It's separating yourself is what God wants. And you know, unfortunately, people still think that that's the way to be Christian. That what God wants is that you separate yourself from people who haven't lived a great life or might need help and so on. I have a friend of mine who's in jail for a bit over 20 years for stuff that he really shouldn't have done. And we still write backwards and forwards about each month. We write, we're friends. But it was interesting, 3 years ago when I was given this new job of being a bishop, he wrote to me and said, I understand the new job, and I also expect that we probably shouldn't have anything to do with one another now. Now that you've been given this new job, you probably won't be able to have anything to do with me. And I wrote back and said, no, that's not the way to think at all. But it's ingrained in people, right? That what God wants is for us to separate ourselves. You see, the way religion works is, it's like a water polo game. I'm good, and the way that I impress God is actually by being better than you. And in water polo, the way you lift yourself up is, of course, you reach out, put your hand on someone else, and push them down and lift yourself up. And that's the way this man thinks he'll be right with God, is by looking down his nose at her. And you notice Jesus sees her in a completely different way. Jesus is compassionate to her. He even defends her. And it costs him to let her touch him in this way. In terms of his reputation as a holy man, for this woman with this reputation to wipe his feet with her hair, it costs him. And yet he lets her do it. In fact, there's an irony built into the story. I don't know if you picked it up. The religious man, the Pharisee, says, oh, he couldn't be a prophet or he'd know what this woman was like. And then Jesus shows he is a prophet by not only understanding the way the Pharisee thinks, what's going on in his head, but by explaining why is it that this woman loves him so much and the religious man thinks very little of Jesus. Look at how he explains it in verse 40, as he so often does with a little story or parable. Jesus said to him, Simon, that's the Pharisee, Simon, I have something to tell you. Tell me, teacher, he said. And then Jesus tells this story. Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Denarii or denarius was a coin. It was worth one day's pay for a day labourer. So what we're talking about here is one person who owed 2 years' wages, another who owed 2 months' wages. Back home where I come from, $100 a day for a day labourer makes the amounts $50,000 and $5,000. You get the difference between the two. But Jesus continues, verse 42, neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? And the answer's not hard to work out, is it? Verse 43, Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house, and you did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. So normal hospitality, someone turned up, you gave them water to wash their feet, you gave them a kiss on, you know, both cheeks, a greeting, and oil, olive oil, to brush the hair out of your face. And Simon the Pharisee had not even done the basis of the basics of hospitality for Jesus, and yet this woman is just completely over the top. Why? Why? The answer is that she understands that Jesus has forgiven her a great debt. See, verse 47, therefore I tell you, her many sins, and he doesn't cover up what she's done. She's lived a bad life, right? Therefore I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much, but he who has been forgiven little loves little. It's not that she earns forgiveness by loving much. Right? In the story, the two people who owe money don't do anything to earn forgiveness. They're just forgiven freely. No. Her love is evidence that she's been forgiven. She's been forgiven much, and as a result, right, or therefore, she loves much in return. Now, Luke doesn't tell us. I don't know whether she met Jesus one-to-one and spoke with him, or whether she just stood at the back of a crowd and heard him teach, but she's understood that he's come to give forgiveness, to wipe the slate clean. And she's accepted that. She's trusted him, and that has transformed her. So if you understand you've had a massive thing forgiven, it will change you. But if you think, well, actually, I'm okay, and I'm a good person, and I'll make it on my own, you see, those who've been forgiven little love little. In verse 48, then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. What's he do? He assures her of forgiveness before God, and she already knows that. I think it's actually done for the other people in the room as well, so they'll treat her the right way. Verse 49, the other guests began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? Now, if sin is an offence against God, it's when we've done the wrong thing before our Creator, the only one who can forgive us is God. And yet, interesting, as you read the Gospels, Jesus accepts worship that's only due to God. He speaks with authority and claims to speak for God, and he forgives things that only God can forgive. In fact, Jesus actually claims to be God become a man. And so verse 50, he said to the woman, your faith has saved you, go in peace. He promises her peace with God, not just now, but forever. Now that's the story. I just want to take a few minutes as we finish up to suggest to you, I can think of three reasons why she weeps. She walks in, she stands at Jesus' feet and she weeps. Three reasons. First one is, she understood the size of her debt. The size of her debt. You know, when you do something wrong to someone, it does feel as if you're in their debt, doesn't it? And we still have used the phrase that criminals in prison are paying their debt to society. Yeah? In the Bible, as Jesus teaches, the idea of doing wrong, the idea of sin and debt are actually used interchangeably. Now, we all have a massive debt to God. You might think, well, not really. I'm a good person. There's all sorts of ways that we kind of downplay that and say, well, I'm as good as the next person, or I haven't done what she's done or he's done. But let me put it to you. What if we had broken the greatest commandment? What if we had actually offended God's laws, how God wants us to live? What if we had done the worst possible thing? And back home, immediately people say, well, no, I've never killed anyone. So that's good, but that's not the greatest commandment. In Mark's gospel, the religious leaders come to Jesus and ask him, what's the greatest commandment? Of all of the Old Testament, of all of those hundreds of pages and so on, what is the number one thing that God wants? And Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. I'll read it again. So you tell me how you see how you're going with that. Love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. And really what Jesus is saying is what God expects is that we would love him and live our lives for him, the one who gives us life. And yet what do? We take all the good things God gives us and we ignore him. We live our lives as if he doesn't matter. And that God says that it does matter. And he will hold us accountable. And if we spend our lives ignoring him, we will die. If we walk away from the source of life, we'll die not just physically, not just spiritually, but eternally. And I suspect this day as she walked into that room, she understood the size of her debt before God. Second reason, she understood the cost of forgiveness. You know, the reason I love this story is that Jesus, he goes into bat for her and puts the religious man in his place. And it costs him to do that. But more than that, I think she weeps because she's understood someone has to pay that debt. Someone has to pay the debt of the wrong things that she has done. And somehow I think she's worked out what Jesus has to do. This is chapter 7. In chapter 9, Luke tells us the words he uses, Jesus will set his face to walk to Jerusalem. And he walks, well, it's almost 100 miles, knowing that every step takes him closer to the cross. And Jesus will die in her place and take the penalty that she deserves. And God will place that guilt on his son, and Jesus dies for her so that she could be forgiven. And for her, forgiveness is free, but it's not cheap. And you know what? He'll die for each one of us as well, so that we can be forgiven if we'll trust him. And I think she understands the cost of what it will cost for her to be forgiven. The size of her debt, the cost of forgiveness, and I think the last thing, joy. I think she weeps just for joy that she can be forgiven, that the slate's wiped clean. Do you know, our consciences can trouble us so much. In Sydney last week, I had lunch with a man who's a little bit older than me, and I think he's just become a Christian. He's just put his trust in Jesus. And he talked to me about walking around with like a great ball of guilt and angst and heartache over things that he'd done. And I was trying to say to him, do you know what? You don't have to feel guilty anymore. Because you're not, because you've been forgiven. I get frustrated when the media puts the boot into Christians. And there's lots of things we do that are annoying, and I know we're slow-moving targets. But one thing I don't like being called is that we're in the guilt business. Because we're not. People get guilty all on their own. We're in the forgiveness business. Right? We're the good news people. We're in forgiveness business. And it's a great joy. A great joy. You see, if you think you're basically a good person and you'll be okay and you can kind of pay off your debts to God, it'll never change you. It won't. I hit 50 last year, and when you get to kind of the middle age, not many people bother with birthday cards, which is just as well. I got two cards the last 2 years, one from my mate who's in jail. He always remembers the date. He's very good. The other, well, here it is. Happy birthday, Alan, from Kirsty and the team at Wizard Home Loans. Right? And that is 18 years ago, Kathy and I took out a mortgage and we're paying the mortgage off bit by bit. And so what are they reminding me as they send me this? Congratulations, Alan. We've got you by the mortgage documents. Keep paying. Keep paying. That's the way some people think about God. That God just keeps score, that we need to keep kind of being good and paying things off. And if that's the way you think about God, you'll never love him. It'll never transform you. What does Jesus say? Jesus says, you have a debt that is so big that you can never repay it, and I have paid it for you. Trust me, it's free. Trust me, it's free. And so the motivation for living the Christian life is not to get into God's good books. It's in response to God's generosity. And because God's been so generous to us, we can be generous to others. Is it glamorous and exciting? No. What does it look like to live the Christian life? It means putting up with other people. It means stacking the dishwasher and one day doing it and not drawing attention to it. But I'll get there eventually. It means going to the in-laws' place and being happy about it. It means spending time with people that you'd rather not be with. It means giving money away. It means being generous. Is it glamorous? No. Is it impressive? Oh, yes. The reason I'm a Christian is that I watched another young guy at university live that way, and it impressed me so much. One last thing to say. This isn't a story just for the ladies. It's a story that men need to read as well. In Australia, we've feminised the Christian faith. There's many ways we do it. We dress our Christian leaders in frocks. We sing Jesus is my boyfriend songs. We say the way to be a Christian is to fall in love with a wonderful man. You put all that together and then wonder why men like my brother just don't get it. I don't need a boyfriend. It's never occurred to me to wipe someone's feet with my hair. But I do need a Lord and Master. I do need someone who will forgive me and someone who will call me as a man to live a life that's bigger than just my own selfish little appetites. If Jesus hadn't grabbed hold of me at the age of 20, in the degree I had, where I would have spent my whole life just chasing money. That's a little life, isn't it? Compared to someone who will love me, call me to live for something bigger, and to do things that have value for eternity. If you've been following Jesus for a while, that's great. But you know, sometimes I see Christians Christians live a life like the horse that walks into a bar. You know that story, don't you? You must have the same story in London. Horse walks into a bar, orders a drink. The barman looks at the horse and says, "Why the long face?" All right? And Christians, we walk around with long faces. And tonight, I just want to remind you, if you follow Jesus, remember the size of your debt, the cost of forgiveness, and the joy of forgiveness. And for some of us who, maybe like my brother, just don't get it yet, can you see why he's wonderful? Can you see why we should trust him, why we should follow him? And how do you do that? It's not hard. You're actually holding the key in your hand. The key is to read his words, understand what he did, and pray that God would open your heart to understand and see who he is and find that forgiveness that he won at such great cost.
We join the speaker and the audience just a few minutes into the session.
Absorb that, the wrong that's done to them. That's not to say that the wrong that's done doesn't matter. Romans chapter 12 says, leave justice to God. God is the one who will bring justice to people. Trust him. It's God's prerogative to repay, and that we shouldn't be seeking to hurt people back. Now, I've forgotten the question. What was
that? All right. I think we're going well there.
Yep.
I'm going to move on away from that to this question mm-hmm. here. I disagree with Jesus mm-hmm. that the person who owes more money to the moneylender will love the moneylender more. I think both men should love the moneylender by the same amount. What did Jesus actually mean when he asked Simon, who loves the moneylender more?
Okay. That's a very good question, because it's actually at the very heart of the whole kind of story. And that is, Jesus is saying, it's not about the two amounts of money, it's about the woman and the man. Why is it that the woman loves Jesus and the man looks down his nose at Jesus? Answer, the woman realises that she's been forgiven so much, she's so grateful, it's changed her life. The man thinks he's good enough for God as it stands, and so who cares about Jesus? And forgiveness, well, he only needs a little bit. And so he loves a little bit in response.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the point of the whole thing. The parable is just a way of explaining what's going on in the room.
Good. Thank you very much. Is forgiveness from Jesus only available to Christians?
I suppose it's saying a Christian is someone who has been forgiven. So I guess it's a way of saying the answer is yes to that. It's anyone who will come and ask him for forgiveness, that the slate might be wiped clean because he paid that price. It's full and free forgiveness available, yes, but only to those who will come and ask and trust him for forgiveness.
Yeah, and so what about somebody who's never made that step? I mean, what position are they in?
they stand unforgiven before God, and to front up before God unforgiven is a terrifying thing. And Jesus warns us about it again and again and again. And I kind of think, if we front up before God, like, are we taping this? We are, okay. I have four or five people that I love with all my heart who are outside of the forgiveness of God because they will not come and ask and trust Jesus in how they live. But I think if they front up before God unforgiven, he could rightly ask, what more did I have to do? I had Jesus die. I had that baldy-headed bloke tell you about it all the time. Like, you just had to trust me. But it's that belief, God is mean or stupid. And if I trust God in how I live, I'll miss out. And so I want to run my own life. And if that's the case, you won't find forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And you won't know God and you won't know life.
And that, just so that we get a little picture of you, a bit more of you, I mean, what brought that change? You saw these people who obviously were living very differently when you were at high school, a bit older.
University. I was 20 when I became a Christian.
Yes. So what was it that drew you?
I'd been brought up in a really strict, religious home. Well, actually, half religious. My mum, really strict Christian, and the way that lots of rules and regulations, and my dad said he was an atheist. So it was a kind of a funny home. But I hadn't understood. I thought Jesus meant rules and regulations and would suck the joy out of life. And it wasn't until I met some people who actually knew him and I understood, no, Jesus had died so I could have life and I could trust him. It was that when God switched the lights on. And that was 30 years ago. And I've got to tell you, the more I walk with Jesus, the more I understand life.
And in terms of forgiveness for you, to know that you're forgiven, I mean, what difference does that make to your life?
It means my conscience is clear. I still ask for forgiveness regularly. I still do the wrong thing and I have to, regularly, and I have to come back and say, look, I'm sorry, I've done it again, please forgive me.
Yes.
And I need to ask other people, like my long-suffering wife, to forgive me at different things regularly. But it means a fresh start, day by day.
Let's move on. Why would I want to be forgiven if my family aren't forgiven? Isn't that rather self-centred? And, you know, I think behind the question, you know, why would I ever want to be somewhere where my family weren't if they're not forgiven?
Yes, it can be hard to... our family and wanting to be close to them is a very powerful thing. And yet family, those relationships, are the gift from God. It's yet another good thing that God gives us. I know it sounds strange to say that Jesus actually calls us to put him ahead of family, and that you can know him and be closer to him than even your family. And that's, he calls us to put him first. Mm. And it's a big call, but he knows exactly, like, he says it again and again, put him first.
It's very interesting too, in some families you find, you know, one person in the family will hear the Christian message, be forgiven, and then it will spread through the family, not in all families, and then it will spread, and you could be the catalyst, actually, to a whole family.
That's a better way to put it. You'll be the first one.
It's not a better way of putting it. It's just a different take on it. Now, this is a big question, and you could have a whole evening looking at this, but I thought it would just be useful to have you answer it. Why is it that God takes the young, those who've done no harm, who have to live yet, still lots to live, and they're taken, leaving others in grief. Someone once said to me on the death of my son, listen, as it says on the sign, don't pluck these blossoms, but it was useless against the wind which could not read. Mm. So why does God, you know, a young child, whatever, why does that happen?
You can only assume that whoever's written this has lost a child, and I have four, and I can't imagine how hard that is. The Bible is very much aware of suffering and pain, and really from the beginning to the end is wrestling with that question of, if you have a God who is good, why is there so much suffering and pain and evil in our world? And the Bible's explanation of it is that the pain and suffering in our world comes from the fact that we have walked away from God, the source of life. And we live in a world under the judgment of God, and there are consequences, but it's not evenly spread. It's not cause and effect. It's not that the bad die early and the good live long. So it's like we live in a swamp and everyone gets mud on them. The Bible's answer is this, that one day God will remake our world and there will be a new creation, where there'll be no more mourning and crying and pain, and where children will not die. And for those who trust him, he will take us there. And why should we trust him? He gave his son so that we might be forgiven. And so sometimes in the pain and suffering and difficulties of life, and I've got probably five friends at the moment, I think, maybe it's just about the joys of midlife, but I could list five friends who have cancer or brain tumours at the moment. In the middle of pain and struggle and so on, it's hard to see how this all works out. And what God says is, look at the cross, understand that Jesus is risen, that he's coming back, trust me, hang on. And so God takes the young, yes, and we grieve and our hearts ache, but the gospel message is the one thing to hang on to in that time. And I've seen five friends who have cancer face death very differently because they know Jesus and because they have that hope. But it still tears our heart out.
Thank you. And there are big parts of the Bible dealing with that as well, aren't there? And
yes.
Helping us to explore it and think it through.
Yep. Book of Job.
And I guess both of our experience, I mean, you know, obviously I've been with families when they've lost young children, and the difference that knowing the presence of Jesus Christ and the reality of future and certain hope completely transforms a situation like that. If God forgives everyone, what is to stop us living wicked lives?
That's a good question. God offers free forgiveness, and yet what does it mean? It means forgiveness from ignoring God, making our own rules, living our own way, to be able to turn around and come back and live with him as God. And so the whole point of forgiveness is to be able to start again living with him. And God promises to change our hearts so that we actually want to obey him now. That's the great miracle in my life. I've gone from ignoring God and saying, he's changed my heart. I actually want to obey him because I believe that he's not mean or stupid and he wants what's best for me. So it's that change, and that is why if you find forgiveness and know Jesus, you'll actually want to live his way.
Thank you very much. If you've been wronged, this moves more into living the Christian life, but if you've been wronged in the work environment, say, should you forgive the person who's wronged you without waiting for an apology?
Very good question. I used to think you had to wait for the apology, but now I realise there's a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. Forgiveness means, could I use you then?
Please.
William does the wrong thing to me and then storms off. Forgiveness means, William, I will not hold this against you. I will not punish you. I'll let it go through to the keeper. But for reconciliation, it takes two to be reconciled. The follower of Jesus should be the one with his or her hand out saying, I forgive you, can we be reconciled? But William has to be in that too. So you can have forgiveness, but not necessarily have reconciliation. I think that's the sharp edge. Also, forgiveness is not the same as saying there's no consequences. What I mean is, you can say to someone, I will not punish you, however, you have shown me a side of your character or the way you have behaved means I will not put myself in the situation to be hurt again. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a non-emotional example. St. Helens here, it turns, I don't know anything about your treasurer. It turns out your treasurer has a gambling problem and has spent all his money, etc., etc. Now, it's a legal thing. You'd have to call the police. You may decide not to punish him or her, but you wouldn't elect them treasurer at the next annual general meeting. Do you see? There's consequences for... Yeah. Now, there's all sorts of issues about sexual abuse and the way children have been treated and all of those things with regard to forgiveness but consequences.
Thank you. That is extremely
I didn't want to talk about the highly emotional Let's talk about the... Don't elect them treasurer again, and you can fill in the dots on other
The treasurer's
examples.
Wife, who is here, will tell it.
Yep, exactly.
Tomorrow,
tonight.
But it was suitably unemotive. That's great. Thank you. Thanks, Al, very much. That's terrific. And this is basically... That was such a clear answer. I mean, it's a really helpful answer. What is forgiveness supposed to look like? When you forgive someone, does it mean that everything must go back to normal? You've really answered that, haven't you? But
yes, forgiveness is saying, I will not hurt you back. And that's why forgiveness costs. C.S. Lewis said, everyone thinks forgiveness is a great idea until they have something to forgive. And it costs to forgive. And does it cost God to forgive us? Oh, yes. Jesus dies in our place. That's what it cost him to forgive, so that he can be just and merciful. And for us to forgive costs. Does it mean that everything goes back? No. There's consequences. It's saying, no, I will not punish you for what you've done.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And then this you linked straight into the next one. Why did Jesus have to die? What's so significant about death, his death on our behalf? How does it achieve forgiveness?
Okay. How long have we got?
Well, we've got a couple of minutes.
Okay. Yeah. The best example of understanding the way why Jesus died is in the Old Testament. God set up a ceremony to explain it. If an Israelite, one of God's people, offended God, they'd broken God's laws, this is what they were to do. They were to go out to their flocks or herds and to find a goat or a lamb or a bull. Let me choose a lamb. A lamb that was without blemish, perfect and innocent. They're guilty. The lamb is innocent. What they were to do was to bring the lamb to the temple where God had promised to be and put their hand on the head of the lamb. And that was to show that somehow guilt could be transferred from them to the innocent one. And the lamb was then killed and his blood poured out. Now, were they forgiven because the lamb died? No. They were forgiven because that action, my guilt on the innocent lamb, pointed to the one sacrifice that truly worked. Where God took my guilt and your guilt and placed that on his innocent son, Jesus, the Lamb of God. And Jesus dies as our substitute, as our representative. He takes our guilt and dies in our place. And that is why God is able to be just, wrongdoing is punished, and also merciful, that he can forgive us. And that is the only way that that was possible. And I know it's the only way because the night before Jesus dies, as he sweats and weeps and prays, he asks, if there's any other way, did he not have to die? And the answer is, it was the only way. And so he chose to do it.
So what if, I mean, there's bound to be somebody who says, well, okay, I've asked Jesus for forgiveness, I've come to God for forgiveness. So what if I don't feel forgiven?
How you feel and reality can take a while to line up. So that... I talked to that businessman last week, and he still doesn't realise or doesn't feel forgiven. And so I can say to him, God has forgiven you, and he can look me in the eye and nod, yes, but he doesn't feel it here yet. And I think it just takes time for him to, you know, I hope I'm going to read the Bible with him when I get back to Sydney regularly. And it'll take time just to, if you like, to rewire his thinking and for his feelings to catch up. God promises objectively, trust Jesus, you'll be forgiven. You can just take time for that knowledge to go from here to here. From the head to the heart can be a long distance sometimes.
Yeah. And to keep looking back to what happened on the cross is
That's
key,
it.
Isn't
that
it?
You know that God has forgiven you because he's promised.
Yes, yeah, thank you. Okay, last question now. If forgiveness by God, the invisible Lord, is free and great... Why do so many people get frightened by the prospect of it? The price to pay for forgiveness to some is to follow God, Jesus' way, that will become too much of a price to pay because Jesus' way may be in conflict with the way they still want.
That is exactly right. Why is it that people are frightened about becoming Christian, or the idea of becoming Christian is scary? Answer, it's actually deciding that instead of making my own choices and doing my own thing, I will trust what God says. And we keep on believing the lie that God is mean or stupid. I'm sorry if that's a bit crass, but I just thought that's preacher's rhetoric. That God either doesn't really want what's best for us or doesn't know what's best for us. And so we just don't want to let go. And yet what Jesus says is, trust him in how we live. See, to find forgiveness, you just need to trust him. But if you see, trust and obedience are two sides of the one coin. To say, I trust Jesus, I just don't live his way, is nonsense. But when you do trust him, you realise he wants what's best for us, he'll look after us, live his way is the best way to live.
Thank you.
But that's why people are frightened about becoming Christian, because it means I'm not the boss anymore, he is. And what if he wants me to do something that I don't want to do? And
another last question. So this really, what if there was somebody here this evening saying, "Look, you know, I don't know if I have turned to Jesus for forgiveness, I really want to be sure of it."
Yep.
What would you encourage them to do this evening?
Pray now. Do it. He's more ready to hear than we are to ask. And so to pray and just say, I'm sorry for what I've done. I know I've done the wrong thing. Haven't loved you with all my heart, soul, mind and strength. Please forgive me. And please help me to start again with you as the boss. And
thank
he
you.
Promises he'll hear that.
Yeah. And somebody could do that just this evening.
Absolutely.
Sort of. Yeah.
I did that in a wooden, portable building at the University of New South Wales in 1979.
Very interesting. I'd noticed it before, but in the back of this little edition of Luke's Gospel, if you turn to the very back page, you'll see that there is a prayer that's been crafted for you to pray if you wanted to do that. So just there, indented on page 96, if you were interested and wanted to do that. Al, very, very many thanks. Thank you for coming over,
thank
all
you,
the way man. Over to England. It's great to have you here. Al's speaking in any number of different places over the next 10 days or so, and people who brought you on your tables will be able to tell you where you'll be able to catch up with him if you'd like to do that. He's actually here tomorrow night, tomorrow lunchtime, and then on various different occasions next week as well. So just ask the person who's brought you and you'll be able to catch up with Al. If you'd like to take a seat then, Al, thank you very much indeed. Let me just tell you one or two other things before we finish. I think I mentioned the Christianity Explored course. Do take hold of that. You might like just to pick it up for a moment from the middle of the table, and you'll see there that the course is explained, and then there's a little response card. And if you're interested in following through with some of the issues, looking at coming on the Christianity Explored course, then that's the thing to take hold of. You'll find under the gallery there, as you go out, there's a Christianity Explored table, and you might like just to talk to the people there who run the course, and they can tell you one or two things, and there are various resources there as well. Thank you very much indeed for coming. We'd love to see you again. We meet at 10:30, 4 and 6 o'clock on a Sunday, and you're most welcome to come to any one of those Sunday meetings. We'd love to see you there. Just remains for me to say a very big thank you to the serving team, all of whom are members of the church family. Thank you very much indeed behind the screen there for helping us this evening. Thank you for coming, and Al and Kathy, thanks so much for coming over.